Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin, sharing one goal, enhancing the quality of life in Wisconsin through the development and maintenance of a strong transportation network. The Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin, it's how we get there.
Because I don't want to go backwards. I want to keep going forward together. That's exactly where we're going to go. God bless.
I'm Steve Walters.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
And this is Rewind. We normally look at 1 week worth of news, but we're looking at 2 weeks worth of news because we were off for Thanksgiving holiday. J.R., let's start with a pretty stunning number. $61.4 million spent by outside groups on state elections does not include direct spending by candidates. Mm-hmm. That's an amazing number. That is 68% higher than 2014. And that's three times higher than 2010.
I think it's 2010 and 2011 combined weren't as much as this one.
Okay, thanks for the, for that correction. Is this a result of the 2015 complete rewrite of campaign finance laws? You used to be able to give $10,000 to a gov. Now you can give $20,000. Is that the reason we saw this huge
increase?
No, because
this is the independent group, so it's not the candidates. There are a couple of things that could be driving. One, there's just more money every cycle. It's not an infinite resource. It is finite, but it could be just that every year it's more expensive to do these kinds of things. More groups get involved. That could be part of it. But I don't know that it's a result of rewrite campaign finance law as much as what was at stake this election. I mean, think about in 10 and 14, yes, we had a change in power, party power in the executive branch, but it was different. Like the Republican wave year, 14, Walker was strong favorite to win re-election, also another Republican strong Republican year. This one was really up for grabs. You know, there's a chance to win, so that might have inspired more spending, you know, a real shot to take up back Wisconsin for Democrats.
And we're getting our numbers, of course, from the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. What about the parity here? The Wisconsin Democracy Campaign totaled pro-Republican group spending at 31.3, pro-Democrat group spending at 30.1. That's almost parity.
Yeah, you know, I don't know their methodology, but the thing that I found, like, I track, so we have two things you have to know here. One, there is issue advocacy, which we know exactly what was spent because you've reported to the state.
Yep.
Okay? Then there's, express advocacy. Issue advocacy, this is like the ad says, Steve Walters is a jerk, calls people, tell me he's a jerk, those kind of ads.
Yep.
Not that I'd run that kind of ad, mind you, but
thank you.
Those ads, those aren't reported. So you have to kind of like figure out through TV buys. The component that's missing from this that might be missing is digital ads. I've talked to campaign aides. You can't track those any way, shape, or form. Even because at least with like TV buys and radio, you can go to like the station, look at the buy, and see how much they spent. Digital ads, there's no central location to figure it out. And that's been kind of growing. I see more digital ads now than I've ever seen before because they're targeting people. So I don't know how complete the total is. But that's one thing I kind of wonder, like, where is that being accounted for?
Right. And let's look at the nine groups that each spent more than $1 million, because those nine groups spent $51.8 million of the $61.4. So let's just run them down quickly. Jump in if you want. The Democratic governor's 10.9, Republican governor's 13.4, Americans for Prosperity, that's the Koch brothers group, Greater Wisconsin, that's the liberal elect Democrats group. Mm-hmm. That was $7 million. Then $1 million from the Wisconsin League of Conservation Voters, WMC 5-3, they weighed in pretty heavily. Republican Attorney General's Association 2.8, Democratic Attorney General's Association 2.1. $1 million from the Republican State Leadership Committee, which is a group I'm not aware of. So
they do legislative races, essentially. The DGA was largely issue advocacy, RGA largely the express advocacy. So we saw those. They had two groups that they ran ads through. Americans for Prosperity is a mix of both. That's what kind of stood out to me about those things, that there was a different approach from them, but they were, you know, got their message across.
So a digital ad, vote for JR, he's a great guy. Is that an issue or an express?
Vote for JR, that is express advocacy. You're directly advocating for the election or defeat of somebody. So it's the magic words. Vote for, vote against, support, oppose, you know, those kinds of things. The ones that don't have that, we see them all the time, like the issue advocacy.
Yeah.
That's the stuff you have to report to the state.
But you'll never see that ad because JR's never going to run for anything.
God,
right?
No.
Okay. Now, I want to get into the lame duck session. Mm-hmm. And I realize that we don't have the agenda and the bill text. We don't know exactly what's going to be before either House as early as next Tuesday. But let's get into it this way. At the start of the week, Senator Fitzgerald said maybe 10 or 11 of the 18 Republican senators would vote for the Kimberly-Clark tax breaks. Quote, it's going to take a significant amount of Democratic votes to get this through. Let's just focus on Kimberly-Clark for now. Do you? I do not expect it to come up because they don't have the votes. Do you?
No. Look, when it was three votes, the best case scenario I heard about 2 weeks ago was that they could keep it to the three public no votes from Republicans. Luther Olson, who's also a Republican senator, he had raised concerns in a joint finance hearing about, the bill. Mm-hmm. So at best case scenario, you keep it to 14 Republicans, the other 14 Republicans, you keep them on board and find three Democrats.
Yeah.
Now you're talking this, it's just too big a mountain to climb.
Right. Okay, now let's talk about some potential subjects. I'm going to go through them, and you're working this every hour, so mm-hmm. add what you want. Reducing the number of the gov appointments to Weedick. Mm-hmm. That's pretty much a lock, isn't it?
I believe so. And the other piece of that we're waiting for to see the details is you would go to parity, essentially, where you'd have the governor's appointments and the minority leader's appointments of the board match the appointments by the majority leader in the Senate, the Assembly Speaker. Then you have a split board. With current political configuration, start January 7th, you'd have a split board equally, right?
Yep.
Then the board would appoint the secretary, or the CEO, they call it, of Weedick. You take that away from the governor. Therefore, Tony Evers would not be able to appoint the leader of Weedick if this goes through.
Okay. Now, is it a lock that they're going to move the election of the Supreme Court?
No.
It's not a lock?
No.
But let's back up. Right now it's scheduled. We're scheduled to elect a Supreme Court justice in 2020 in April.
Yep.
With the presidential primary.
The same day, yes.
Okay. Now they're talking about backing it to March.
Or going later, one of the two.
And Senator Fitzgerald, in a moment of candor, said that would give incumbent Justice Daniel Kelly a better shot.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Absolutely.
But now you've been reading this by the hour. What's your read on it now?
Robin Voss told me after a caucus on Tuesday that they had consensus, broad consensus in his caucus on several things, including the change, the date in the primary. Fitzgerald said, they're still working on it and talking to Republican senators. They don't have consensus on that. Now, they can pull it out of the fire and get it done, but right now, there's a split in the two houses about that provision.
Okay. Now, in the last 12 hours, I see that they're committed to passing something prohibiting discrimination based on pre-existing conditions when you buy health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a lock for the lame duck agenda?
Waiting for final language. It looks like there has some momentum behind that. It's a question of, I don't know because of the, I'm not a lawyer, but how closely they can match a state law to the protection of the Affordable Care Act. I don't think, from what I've been told, they can go as far as the ACA does or Obamacare. So it's a matter of what's the language look like to enact those protections in state law.
Okay. And I noticed your newsletter yesterday, they're talking about changes in the tax law.
Possibly.
The U.S. Supreme Court ruling said if you're an online retailer, you must pay state's sales taxes. And the issue is, should that additional money to the state treasury be sent back to taxpayers in a tax cut? Although that's kind of a shell game.
Sure. That was one idea being discussed. Also, if you remember, U.S. Senator Ron Johnson with the federal tax bill held it up because he wanted to have a better treatment for pass-throughs. They look like they're trying to federalize state law to match what that does. So there's still things that I didn't have the full details on how it's going to look, but they're moving toward some of that stuff.
Okay. What do you expect to be announced later today in terms of an agenda and a schedule? Are we going to see joint finance meet, public hearings on Monday, then Senate in on Tuesday, or is it just too much up in the air?
Tentative plan was to have joint finance come in on Monday, Senate, at least somebody on Tuesday. I don't know the full agenda yet. They haven't made it clear because they're still, from what I can tell, I'm talking to some senators, Republican senators, they're still trying to get consensus on some things, and they're still concerned about provisions they're hearing about in these bills. We haven't seen the final bill draft yet as of, we sit here Friday morning, so that will shape the conversation dramatically about what's actually in and what it would do.
We have still also not seen the formal agenda for a joint finance meeting,
mm-mm.
So there's a lot of unanswered questions. Now let's talk about the process. I'm so intrigued. The Assembly, Mr. Voss, is interested in one mammoth bill, whereas the Senate wants to run separate bills, correct?
That's last I heard, yes. So we'll see where they end up on that. Now, part of the philosophy is with one bill, if you have members that don't like certain provisions but mm-hmm. like others, then they have to swallow it and vote for the whole thing.
Yep.
That makes it easier to get it through, or could get it easier to make it through, a tight window like in the Senate. Fitz seems to know that he's got a more difficult task with that people will pick it apart or he's going like bill by bill to try and make it easier for his caucus to digest, it looks like.
And it's also very possible that they cannot get consensus and these bill drafts by Tuesday, so we don't even know the timing.
Entirely possible. Okay. So there is a push to get this thing done and get it done quickly.
Okay, new subject. Were you surprised that Governor Walker now has signed off on an amendment to the Forest County Potawatomi Compact, which says if there is another casino within 30 or 50 miles of their casino in Milwaukee, they get to withhold $250 million, $250 million, give us the background on that. Because I know that there was a dispute, and at one time the Potawatomi said, we want the right to withhold $500 million.
Well, this is
so
all
this
about,
was cut in half.
This
Excuse
is all
me.
About certainty, okay, for everybody involved in this. This issue actually goes back to 2003 when then-Governor Jim Dole signed the original compact with the Potawatomi to expand gaming. Before that, I think we in Wisconsin could have, like, you know, you couldn't have Las Vegas-style games. Well, the compacts that Doyle signed expanded what you could offer for more money that helped balance the state's books. As part of that original compact in 2003, there was an exclusivity agreement with the Potawatomi. Mm-hmm. It was nixed, though, how large it was. They agreed then to a one of exclusivity of, I think, 30 miles with this window of 30 to 50, where if something happened, there'd be compensation. They've gone back and forth about this for years. Finally, with the Menominee proposal for Kenosha that was rejected by Walker some years back,
right,
that brought this to a head. They started getting into electoral discussion because that would have been within that kind of 30 to 50 mile window. Now they have this agreement. What this agreement basically says is that, okay, if something like this happens, which is still a big if, this is what's going to happen. One, the Potawatomi have certainty about, okay, how much they would be, you know, they would be compensated for in losses. The state has certainty because before they could have been $500 million, they estimated. Now it's $250. Also, it wouldn't be for like entertainment losses, like food, entertainment at the Potawatomi flagship.
Right.
It's only about revenue from gaming.
Gaming.
All kinds of certainty. It also provides certainty if you are a tribe looking to put a new casino in southeastern Wisconsin of what the cover charge is, if you will, to get in the market. So you would then know, okay, we're going to have to figure out a way to compensate the state of Wisconsin to make up those losses in the Potawatomi, because any governor is going to want to see that money, you know, well, more likely, I won't say for sure, but more likely would want to see that money covered to make sure the state's not losing anything in the deal.
Okay, I didn't file this issue, so I was kind of surprised by the development this week. Is this a sign that the Potawatomi, who were willing to accept the reduced withholding from $500 million to $250, are really afraid that Governor Evers might sign off on the old Kenosha casino?
I don't know, because if they're going to bring it back, they have to go back to the BIA,
yep.
I believe,
yep.
Which we don't know the Trump administration, where they're at when it comes to things like this. So even if you want to bring back this whole proposal, I'm not an expert on gaming law, but if you want to bring it back, I believe, you have to go back to the BIA, you'd have to get the Trump administration to sign off, and then it goes to Governor Evers, then he would get his say in it. So it could be a ways off before that anyway.
Well, happens. You and I and the rest of the Capitol Press Corps have asked Governor Evers during the campaign a lot of questions. What has he said about tribal gaming compacts?
I don't know if we even asked this one.
I agree. Okay. And it's also important that the conditions here. The tribe could only withhold $250 million if, one, if the BIA and the future governor approved the casino, and if the Potawatomi documented a loss in gaming
receipts. And that's important
receipts.
Because, remember, when the Menominee proposed this casino and it was under consideration, the Potawatomi began withholding payments to the state as kind of like a bargaining move in this whole thing. So that provides certainty as well about what happened to prevent that from happening again.
Okay, new subject. This was the last meeting this year of the Legislative Study Committee on alcohol enforcement, beverage sales. I've got the title completely mm-hmm. wrong, but you know what I'm talking about. It was a pretty amazing group because you had the Tavern League, and then you had the wineries, and then you had beers, and you had all kinds of businesses in this state that sell alcohol at the table. And it was a very interesting discussion from a news standpoint, but it didn't generate much. At this week's meeting, they backed the new law requiring companies to report to the Revenue Department the type and amount of alcohol bought online and shipped into the state. Violators could be fined. This is a long way from becoming law, by mm-hmm. the way. And endorse requiring those shipping alcohol in the state to acknowledge Revenue Department's jurisdiction, giving the state new authority. But this was triggered by Senate Majority Leader Fitzgerald late this session sponsored a bill. I'm hearing that there is so much dissatisfaction with the State Revenue Department interpreting laws regarding alcohol that we need a czar. Now, this committee couldn't agree on a czar.
No.
And it couldn't agree. It did not act on regulating wedding barns, which is so controversial, despite Mr. Attorney General Schimel's advisory ruling. And it's important that it's advisory. It does not have the full effect of law that wedding barns should have liquor licenses. Now, we'll get to wedding barns a little bit later, but your thoughts on this amazing conglomerate of special interests that didn't really go anywhere?
Well, the whole point of this committee was to provide clarity to the law, and we're not going to get clarity out of the committee. And that's the bottom line.
Right.
Rob Swearingen, the Republican from Rhinelander, who's the chair of the committee.
And a restaurant owner and a former president of the Tavern League of Wisconsin, although he told me I don't have a conflict. I'm sorry.
Yeah, the Tavern League views wedding barns as competition. You know, he's saying, okay, Brad Schimel issued this opinion. That means it's settled. Nobody else I talked to thinks it's settled. All right? I mean, not to say nobody, but most folks I talked to think, no, it's not settled, because there are all kinds of questions of, okay, what is Governor-elect Evers going to do when he takes over? I mean, we only have a month left of Governor Walker being in charge. I don't get the impression that his Department of Revenue wants to rush in, especially in the non-wedding season, to try and dictate what's going to happen. So what's Evers going to do? There's a big question about that. Yeah. Oh, by the way, can they agree on a law change? What will local district attorneys do? Will they go ahead on their own and say, well, you know, I got this opinion from Brad Schimel. I'm good to go try and enforce this locally. It could be a hodgepodge of enforcement around the state.
Right. And a national study rated alcohol sales in Wisconsin as $7.92 billion. We have, in, as many other states do, a three-tier system, manufacturers, wholesalers, and retailers. That's just, there's just a lot of money on the table here.
Anytime you push any piece of that three-tiered system, you get pushback. The craft brewers, for example, they feared, I remember this conversation 15 years ago, fearing that the big breweries, you know, your Millers, your Coors, your Budweisers, that their distributors, that the distributors that like work with them, wouldn't put room in their trucks for the craft beers. And if they can't get onto the distributor, how do they put their product out? So the all this moving to try and adjust to a changing alcohol scene in Wisconsin. Breweries have, these small breweries have tasting rooms now. Is that a bar or is that a tasting room? Like, there's a conflict there. Wineries, they have tasting rooms now. How do you regulate those? What hours should they be open?
Wineries and beers, things like that. Representative Swearingen, when I interviewed him on this, estimated that there are between 250 and 300 wedding barns. So let's listen to him, what he said about wedding barns, and we're going to stick with the Attorney General because he thinks the Attorney General got it right. Let's listen to Representative Swearingen.
In light of Attorney General Brad Schimel's opinion, it's my thought that we should just continue to operate under what he would agree is current law, which is the fact that via his informal opinion that wedding barns do need to be licensed. I do plan on following up with the current Department of Revenue and the current Department of Revenue Secretary to see if they will be moving forward on any change in their enforcement policy. And of course, moving ahead then, the new Attorney General elect and whoever the new Secretary of the Department of Revenue will be on January 8th or 7th, will be interesting to see how they interpret the current law that is being interpreted now by at least a couple of attorney generals that agree that wedding barns or that type of venue do need to be licensed if they're serving alcohol.
Another thing that happened last week when we enjoyed it at Thanksgiving with our families, DOA projected tax revenues will increase by $2.2 billion through mid-2021, kind of the framework beginning the debate over the next state budget. Well, let's make a list of the demands on that $2.2 billion. Governor Evers wants $1.4 billion more for K-12. The budget submitted by the Department of Health Services asks $836 million more for Medicaid. The budget submitted by the Department of Revenue says if Foxconn hits its hiring and development goals, that could cost $231 million in Foxconn tax breaks in the next biennium. We don't know what the increase is going to be, the budget for corrections or the UW system. And, JR, didn't Governor Evers in the final week say, I would like a middle-class tax cut scoring about $300 million? So the point is, he's got a tremendous number of more demands than we're going to have money.
Look, there's a $1.1 billion deficit, okay? Yeah. There's no deficit, let's be honest, all right? This is a number that assumes every single agency gets every dollar request, which never happens. And oh, by the way, that $1.1 billion includes $180 million in tax cuts that Governor Walker proposed in the campaign. Do you think Tony Evers is going to push Governor Walker's campaign promises on tax cuts? No. She dropped it $900 million right away. Oh, by the way, Tony Evers wants to accept federal money to expand Medicaid. What's that do to the Medicaid budget and the requests that they have? He can cut back his now. People don't think he'll cut back his own DPI budget because that's what he ran on. But UW asked for $300 some million. So what do you do there? I mean, there are lots of ways. This deficit is not real. What is real, though, is he has the best revenue picture of his two predecessors walking in the door on the first day.
Yes.
That is two. And now, part of that $2.1 billion is in this biennium because revenue growth is going to be better than we thought in this biennium. So he's got $2.1 billion to play with in new money on top of what we're spending right now. And here's the thing. I don't know if it matters because whatever he proposes, Republican lawmakers have basically said, we're not going to work off of his budget. We're going to work off the current budget and insert new numbers that we want. So how's that going to look? Oh, Evers wants to do so. His middle-class tax cut, he has said, for example, he would pare back manufacturing ag credit to pay for most of it. I mean, like, this budget is going to be fascinating from the perspective of how are they going to reach a deal? Back with Doyle, right, in 2003, he was at veto pen and crossed out all kinds of stuff. What do they do with Evers?
Well, and let's say the Joint Finance and the Republican leaderships works off our current budget base. Mm-hmm. They then defeat all the Democratic amendments, put this budget on his desk, and he has a Senate Majority Leader Fitzgerald says he has the strongest veto power. But one potential, could he veto the whole thing? Hey,
absolutely.
You wouldn't listen to me? Start over.
So with when I bring up Doyle, the veto power has changed a little bit since 2003. They've reined it in. They've also protected the transportation fund. Remember, in 2000 is a three budget, right? Doyle crossed out $1.1 billion in transportation money and moved over to education. I think it was 2003. That can't happen anymore, right? You also have some restrictions, but it's still very powerful. That's the thing that Republicans are talking about is how do you write a budget that limits what Evers can do with his veto pen? Because you can cross out paragraphs, you can cross out sentences, you can change things. Now, I don't think he can increase spending. You got to cut it down.
You got to write it down, I think.
So how's that going to play out? Yeah. That's fascinating to watch.
Okay, another fascinating thing. Shortly after he conceded the election to Democrat Josh Call, Republican Attorney General Brad Schimel is named a Waukesha County judge. Mm-hmm. He was raised, I think, in Maguanago. He started his career as assistant DA. So that was news in and of itself. And then, of course, Democratic Chair Martha Lanning said, you know, oh, that's a bad thing. So I took a look then at the number of judges that the governor has appointed. So two of the seven Supreme Court justices, seven of the 16 Court of Appeals judges, 65 of the 247 Circuit Court judges. Now, if you add all that up, it equals about almost one in three Wisconsin judges. Now, that's not true because judges like James Troupas in Dane County was appointed and then he didn't seek reelection. Yeah. But is there any doubt that the governor has had a large hand in reworking our number of judges and justices?
Sure. I mean, Rebecca Bradley, for example, she was already going to run for the Supreme Court when she was appointed that fall or the spring. Being the incumbent gave her a leg up for sure in her retention bid. If you're Daniel Kelly, you want to be the incumbent running. You have the power of the robe. That's a big thing. With Schimel, what's fascinating is, so this vacancy opened up in, I believe, September. They're taking applications, I think they're due by October. And all of a sudden, in November, he gets appointed. So I've asked, and I've not received back yet, my open records request, the applicants for the job, the finalists for the job. Because I'm curious, did Brad Schimel, for example, push anybody to run or to seek this? I mean, you're thinking Waukesha County, he's from Waukesha County,
yes,
he's top
is.
Cop in Wisconsin. There's likely a tie between him and somebody who applied for the job. Now, with Schimel, you can't question his qualifications for a circuit judge appointment, right?
No, you can't.
I mean,
you can't, absolutely cannot.
DA's office from 1990 on. I mean, remember, these are, you know, first-time judges for the most part, you know, appointed. DA's office from 1990 on, he won election in Waukesha County. In 2006, he won the primary for that open seat for the DA's office. And 4 years later, he was unopposed for re-election. He won 66.61% of the vote in Waukesha County just in November in the AG race.
Right.
So whoever Walker appointed has to seek retention in April. So Schimel has got the name ID. He's got a campaign infrastructure ready. He's won election. That's all good things for Brad Schimmel. The questions I hear, the process. How do you get the appointment? How is this fair? You know, do other people apply? And, you know, but governors have that power. They have that power to appoint where they want.
Governor Walker took a few days to talk to the press, and he finally did. Has Mr. Schimmel talked to people like you and I about his loss? And
we've been asking his office just when he's going to resign to become judge, and we don't know yet.
And he'll get a response. Okay, we're almost out of we got a few minutes left, but let's jump to your stock report. Rising.
Real quick, deer hunt. The Wisconsin deer hunt's been on a downward decline for years. Two good things this year. One, 7% more deer were culled this year. I mean, if you're looking at that as a sign of success. 7% more deer culled. Also, the safest hunt on record, 3 non-fatal shootings.
Yes.
Tops the previous best of only 4. So,
okay. You know, good news. Deer hunt, mixed.
So, Daniel Kelly, look, as we said, I don't know for sure.
Walker appointee up in 2020.
I don't know for sure if Republicans will actually move the primary, presidential primary off the 2020 April ballot, okay? There's a difference in opinion. The idea, though, is that if Kelly is up for re-election and or retention, I should say, in 2020, you have a contested Democratic primary for president, and you have Dem turnout that's high because of that, it's a very high mountain for him to climb. Whether they change it or not, they've already handed his opponents a great message of this guy is so partisan that Republicans are willing to monkey the election to keep him on the bench.
Yep.
That's not what you want as Supreme Court justice, because as Supreme Court justice, you want an air of being above the fray. This pulls you down into the political mire of what goes on in Madison. Now, here's the thing, too. Don't forget, that race could be for control of the court if liberals win the open seat this April. Mm-hmm. Lisa Neubauer, appeals court judge, and
Ryan Hagedorn,
another appeals court judge, Hagedorn or Walker appointee.
By the way, Neubauer appointed by Doyle, Hagedorn appointed a former chief counsel to Walker, appointed by Walker.
They're both up for the seat of retiring liberal justice Shirley Abramson. Right now, conservatives have a 4-3 majority. Liberals have to win that seat in April to have the shot for 2020. And here's the thing. One, will it even matter in 2020? If Hagedorn wins, it's all a moot point.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, if control of the court is really up, and it would be flip it for the first time in really a decade or so, right?
Yeah.
12 years. If it's really, truly at play, they're going to open their wallets big time. The conservative groups will, mm-hmm. to try and retain that seat. So there are all these things that you're all saying, just hand this issue to liberals to go, hey, this guy, you know, he's a little bit on the up and up. These guys are monkeying with stuff. So I don't know if they're going to do it, but they have not helped them out. Now, the caveat is, will voters remember in a year and a half?
That's true.
But
very
I
true.
Bet you someone try and remind them in April of 2020.
And then falling.
Wedding Barnes. We talked about this a little bit.
What an emotional issue.
Here's the thing. This opinion by Schimmel has opened the door to lots of like, well, what ifs? What if, for example, my family rents a warehouse somewhere and we have a big giant gathering, we bring alcohol. Do we have to have a license? What about the Packer party houses up in Green Bay where I'll be on Sunday? They rent these things out. They have a liquor license. They have people there for alcohol. There are all kinds of like what ifs. This whole point of the committee was to try and provide clarity to this issue, and they have it. Remember, that winery bill back in the spring that passed to extend hours had this provision about wedding barns, and all of a sudden, Senate went, wait a second, this is going to impact tailgating at Lambeau Field, because if you pay to park in somebody's yard, you're paying a fee to rent a spot. If you drink beer, do you have a liquor license? All these questions have been raised, and there's no clarity. We are back at square one in this issue, and I don't know how it's going to play out in the next session.
Okay. You're going to be Lambeau Field?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Cardinals 2-7, Packers 4-6-1. Do I have this right?
Yes, you do.
Okay. I've invited a special guest to join us for next week's Rewind. I haven't gotten word, so I better not say who it is, but I'm Steve Walders.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
And that's Rewind for November 3-0.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin. Sharing one goal, enhancing the quality of life in Wisconsin through the development and maintenance of a strong transportation network. The Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin. It's how we get there.